Please be seated. The gospel this morning is an answer to a question. Four verses before today's passage, Jesus asked his followers, "Who do people say that I am?" And they struggle to respond. "John the Baptist," says one. "Elijah," wonders another. "Maybe a prophet," they stammer. Curious, he presses for more. "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter blurts out, "The Messiah." All of their descriptions are predictable observations about the surface of things, events they have experienced or changes for which they hunger, but they miss the point. They're looking for salvation or healing or deliverance or redemption as an external agent. God will come into our situation as some figure and make things better. But Jesus offers a different way. Jesus says quite openly that the Son of Man, which is not a title at all, but a translation of the phrase human being or the human one, he says he must suffer and be rejected by the authorities, be killed, and then will rise. "Do you want real change inside and outside?" Jesus asks implicitly. "Then take up your cross." Peter, presumably speaking for the rest of the gang, will have none of it. "No," he says to Jesus, "not at that cost. To the one who has engaged an unclean spirit, taken the hand of a feverish woman, embraced a leper, said that sinners are forgiven and that outcasts are welcome, silenced a storm and provided food for thousands two times in situations where folks said there was nothing to share," Peter says, "no." "If it requires suffering and death," Peter suggests, "then I guess I'll just settle for the status quo." No wonder Jesus responds as he does. "There's no new life without dying first," he says. "There's no transformation without change. How can we be reborn without labor pain?" wisdom wonders. So he instructs him, "Get behind me, tempter." At this point in the narrative, the truth about the way is too hard for Peter to take, as Jesus plainly speaks what the disciples and the rest of us would leave unspoken. We have to die in order to rise. We have to change if our systems are going to change. We have to make our schools stronger, our streets safer, our elected officials honest and wholesome. We have to do that. Who do we think will save us? It's like when my three-year-old friend sat at the top of a new slide and said, "Too hard, too high, too big." And when I told her, "I hear you, but you've got to slide down," she responded, "Don't tell me what I don't want to know." We don't want to hear it either, and neither do the disciples. Beneath the surface of what we say to one another, there is a great deal that goes unsaid, things we shrink from saying or are afraid to hear. Understandably, we don't often talk about the things we don't say and why we don't say them, but we should. What goes unsaid has enormous power. An iceberg moves not because of the wind that blows on its exposed surface, but because of the currents pushing against its hidden bulk in the water. What difficult, healing truth needs to be spoken in our families, in our offices, in our city, and our country? What notions or systems or customs must die and be buried so that something truer and more life-giving can rise in their place? Some of us don't realize the power of words unsaid until a loved one dies without warning, suddenly aware of all the things that we wanted or needed to say. When working with the bereaved, it's not unusual for someone to ask, "Why was I so quick to criticize? Why did I hang on to my anger? Why didn't I pick up the phone and say, I'm sorry? For some of us, guilt is the largest portion of pain in losing someone. Death can expose our tendency to take others for granted or reveal our reluctance to offer our thanks. In life, we might expect others to know how we feel, but death makes clear the stinginess of our expression. Of course, it's not only those who mourn that experience the enormous power of the unspoken. Often, families or systems conspire together to keep silent, to banish some unacknowledged truth that they feel is just too awful to accept. So we get the fantastic versatility of alcoholic households who do not in any way acknowledge the source of their daily misery. Or we get schools where evidence shows punishment is handed out differently to poor children, and especially to black boys. Or we get offices where women are expected to ignore belittling remarks or less pay for equal work. Or legislation which privileges the few. We leave the important truths locked up in the realm of the unspoken out of inertia or out of fear, worried about the sanctions that people or parties might impose against us when we break the conspiracy of silence. And we fail to say certain things for fear that the mirror will be turned back toward us, wrongly convinced that our own blemishes discredit our capacity to take a stand and make a difference. And the truth is that as long as something is left unsaid, we can remain safe, concealed, and on the sidelines, free to kibitz and complain and backtrack. Just consider the power of the young people in Florida last week, who finally revealed the unspoken truth of anyone who has buried a victim of gun violence. They said it. They said, it is never too soon to talk about gun control. They said it. They said, this is not about Republicans and Democrats. They said it. They said, maybe adults are used to saying things are the way they are, but if we students know anything, it's that if you don't study, you'll fail. And they said, and so we also know that if we don't act now, people will continually die. They said it. And they also said, it doesn't have to be this way. Change is coming, they said, and it starts now. Our young voices will be heard. They spoke the unspoken. I say all this because of the power that is unleashed when Jesus states his bit of uncomfortable truth. He says, I am not the Messiah that you've been waiting for. Hear it now, digest it, and let's move on. I will not swoop in and take control of the political authorities and put my friends in power. Christ's power is not about trading one Caesar for another. God won't save us in that way. If we haven't caught it before this point in the gospel, Jesus makes it absolutely clear here that God doesn't much care about whether we're comfortable or not. Rather, God cares about us living consciously and honestly and courageously. And he says that we are called to embody integrity and love. He says, if you want to have a worthwhile life, you're going to have to look for ways to give your life away. If we want to save our lives, says Jesus, we're going to have to hand over our petty obsessions and mistaken priorities. We're going to have to think more of loving than of being loved, more of understanding than of being understood, more of forgiving than being forgiven. Living a life that really matters will not allow room for clutching or hoarding or playing it safe. It asks instead for a less possessive way, a way that treats life like a gift to be shared instead of a commodity to be stored away. Because we were on the advanced math track and studied French, for 3 years at Hall High School, Elizabeth and I took every single class together, 3 years. We worked on trig problem sets. We dissected a frog at the same lab bench. We read over each other's English essays and played music together. I valued her insight and humor in class and her vigorous, quirky intelligence. We were companions, familiar travelers among 1,400 other students. But the truth is, I didn't really know her. And I regret that. On the day that Elizabeth turned 18, she took the money that she'd earned at a part-time job, bought a shotgun, and used it to take her life on that day. On the day that it was legal to buy a gun in Arkansas, she took the money that she had earned and took her life. I'd never been to a funeral home before. And I remember being struck by the pink bulbs in the overhead lights that shone down on us. Her family asked me to sit with them during the service, and I remember that they piped in music that we were used to listening to in the car on the radio. We all felt numb and guilty and sad. That summer, I got a letter from her dad. He wrote, "I'd always hoped that Elizabeth would be a student at Yale, where I taught for 4 blissful years after graduate school, where I met my wife, and where Elizabeth was born." He said, "Would you mind if I wrote to you every now and then while you're a student there? Maybe you can share what you're seeing and learning, and I can share with you what I'm teaching." He said, "It won't bring Elizabeth back to life, but I think it'll be nice. It'll be nice to hear from you and celebrate your milestones." And the last thing he said was, "And I'll understand if you say no." We wrote back and forth for 4 years. And as things go, we lost touch after that. And you know, it was years before I could appreciate what our correspondence meant to me, to both of us. I think I'm still figuring out what it means. And last week, when the high school students in Florida were killed, I thought about Elizabeth and her gun, and I went looking for her dad. And I found him. He probably had no idea how it would hit me, but when his name came up in my email, in the inbox, it was over the subject line that he had written, "I'm alive. I have a lot of giving thanks to catch up on with him." Nothing in us that has not died will ever be raised from the dead, wrote C.S. Lewis. And I would argue that this principle runs through all of life from top to bottom. Give up yourself and you'll find your real self. Keep nothing back. No more half-truths or life-giving words left unspoken. Say it. Even the things that are hard to say. And when we follow Christ in this way, we become Christ to each other, and loving this way is finally what saves us and saves the world. Amen.